There was a major Hillary Clinton campaign rally in Center City, Philadelphia today, but without the candidate who's still recovering from pneumonia. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Clinton had a pretty potent stand-in, President Barack Obama, and WHYY's Dave Davies was there.
Hello, Philadelphia!
It was a warm reunion between Obama and Philadelphia Democrats who've given him big receptions and huge electoral wins in his own presidential campaigns. He was back asking for the same kind of effort for Clinton. He said he wasn't just going through the motions, that he was seriously, personally committed to her, which he said some find surprising because they remember how Obama and Clinton battled in 2008 for the Democratic nomination.
And it was tough, because Hillary's tough. Every time I thought I had that race won, I was like going up the rocky steps, you know? I was about to celebrate, and then I look, and she's right there. And I got whooped here in Pennsylvania. She whooped me.
But Obama said this election amounts to a fundamental choice about who we are as a people, about the very meaning of America.
This isn't Abraham Lincoln's Republican Party. This is a dark, pessimistic vision of a country where we turn against each other. We turn away from the rest of the world. They're just fanning resentment and blame and anger.
He criticized Donald Trump, of course, but he also borrowed a trick from Trump's rallies, in which the candidate turns the crowd's attention to the press riser behind the audience.
But I sure do get frustrated with the way this campaign is covered. Guys in the back, I'm just telling you the truth about how I feel about this. Do you mind if I just vent for a second?
Obama said nobody grades the presidency on a curve, but somehow Trump seems to escape the kind of scrutiny that others get.
Donald Trump says stuff every day that used to be considered as disqualifying for being president. And yet, because he says it over and over and over again, the press just gives up, and they just say, well, yeah, okay.
Obama didn't address any of the controversies that have dogged Clinton during the campaign, about her emails, the Clinton Foundation, her health, or her calling some Trump supporters deplorables. He did say when she joined his administration as Secretary of State, he saw what she was made of.
And so for 4 years, I had a front row seat. I watched her intelligence. I watched her judgment. I watched her discipline. I saw her in the Situation Room where she argued in favor of the mission for bin Laden.
He called Clinton the most qualified person, woman or man, ever to seek the presidency and urged the crowd to register their friends to vote and work hard for a win in November. Obama's visit underscores the importance of Pennsylvania in the presidential contest. Just a few hours after his speech, Trump is scheduled to speak at an event in Delaware County. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Meanwhile, near President Obama's rally for Hillary Clinton, about 100 demonstrators stood in solidarity with Native Americans, now fighting an oil pipeline that would run through sacred land. The Dakota Access Pipeline would bring oil from North Dakota's Bakken shale fields east to Illinois. President Obama halted the construction last week while federal agencies reconsider permits issued for the project. Kitty Height of Philadelphia says Obama needs to do more to reduce the country's reliance on fossil fuels.
I hope that he hears that there are people not just in North Dakota but all over the country who think that this pipeline is not the answer to our energy needs. It's not the answer to the jobs crisis. It's not the answer to our environmental crisis.
The $3.8 billion pipeline project will carry some 500,000 barrels of crude each day. The Standing Rock Sioux tribe opposes the project because it would run through sacred land and burial sites. They are also concerned that a pipeline accident could pollute their drinking water supply. Next month will mark 2 years since Uber X launched in Philadelphia. As WHYY's Todd Bookman reports, new numbers reveal that the ride-hailing company's impact on the city's taxi drivers has been catastrophic.
Back in the fall of 2014, in the month just before Uber X rolled into town, city taxi drivers completed about 1 million rides. Let's call that peak taxi. Now compare that with this July. With competition from Uber and Lyft, cabbies completed just 600,000 trips, 40% fewer. Ronald Blunt calls that a job killer.
So a lot of full-time jobs in the taxi industry is collapsing. and it's becoming part-time work.
Blunt is president of the Taxi Workers Alliance. He says 6,000 local drivers used to make their living in cabs. Today, that's down to about 3,500.
We just think for the overall good of the city, I think taxi drivers have to be a part of the transportation economy. I'm not saying we have to be the total part. We have to be some of it.
Exactly how to handle that balance of old and new transportation has vexed officials from the start. Uber and Lyft were technically illegal and subject to huge fines in Philadelphia, even as the public was clamoring for their services. That changed this summer when the ride-booking companies got a temporary green light, a light that turns red at the end of this month. In Harrisburg, pending legislation would permanently legalize the ride-hailing companies, but also protects the Philly cabbies by easing some regulations. Senator Camara Bartolotta says lawmakers know they've got to get new rules in place quickly.
This is something we've got to get done. It's got to move. There's a timeline here. We've gotten this ball at least to the 50-yard line, if not farther.
But whether that effort can save the struggling cabbies isn't yet clear. For WHYY News, I'm Todd Bookman.
When it comes to spending on public education, everyone has an opinion about how much money is enough and how much is fair. But should the Pennsylvania Supreme Court weigh in on that debate? As Keystone Crossroads' Kevin McCrory reports, justices considered that option today in front of a packed courtroom in Philadelphia.
The question now before the state Supreme Court is simple. Does it have the authority to judge whether leaders are fulfilling the promise made in the state constitution? That promise? To, quote, provide for the maintenance and support of a thorough and efficient system of public education. If they think they have the power to weigh in, the justices will allow the case to proceed, and the plaintiffs will get their day in court. The plaintiffs are a coalition of parents, school districts, and advocates, and they'll argue that the judiciary needs to force the legislature to put more money into what they say is a broken and unfair system. During oral testimony Tuesday, the spectators in the closed courtroom got a glimpse into the thinking of the justices. Brad Elias, the attorney for the plaintiffs, argued that the legislature has done little to align its expectations for schools and students with the actual costs of meeting standards. Justice Max Baer, a Democrat, pushed back, likening the case to legal quicksand. "You want us to lean on the legislature? I'm not sure that's our role," he said. Later, speaking to an attorney for the state, Justice David Wecht, another Democrat, seemed flustered at the suggestion that the court had no business deciding if the state constitution was being upheld. "So all is beyond the realm of the court," he said. "There has to be a forum to listen to a challenge." In response, the attorney for the state, John Knorr, said that, quote, "no individual has any right under the education clause of the constitution." He argued that the legislature must simply set up a system, meaning that there are schools and that they are funded by the state. "It has done that," he said, and, quote, "there it remains until the people of Pennsylvania tell us otherwise." After the hearing, advocates fumed at the state's position.
"The governor and the legislature jointly argued that as long as the schools are open, it doesn't matter whether they have the resources to operate and ensure our kids meet their standards. And that's appalling.
Donna Cooper, head of Public Citizens for Children and Youth, was a top aide to former Governor Ed Rendell. On this issue, she's become an outspoken critic of Governor Tom Wolf, a Democrat who sided with top legislative Republicans in saying education funding is not a matter for the courts to decide.
"It's disappointing, it's short-sighted, it's ill-advised, and hopefully it's a failed strategy. I hope the court acts for the kids."
Wolf spokesman Jeffrey Sheridan defended the governor.
"So whatever the legislature and the governor say is thorough and efficient is thorough and efficient."
"Well, I can only speak for the governor. I'm telling you that the Constitution explicitly lays out that this is between the General Assembly and the governor. The governor himself, Governor Tom Wolf, is going to continue fighting for more education funding because right now there is not adequate funding for education. But he's going to introduce more funding in his next budget."
A statement by Wolf on WHYY's Radio Times earlier in the summer seems to contradict his legal position Tuesday.
"Our Constitution says thorough and efficient education, and I think the William Penn School District suit is questioning whether we're in fact delivering on that. I kind of agree we're not, but the courts will have to rule on that."
Governor Wolf's bedfellows in this case had a stronger rebuke of the plaintiffs. A top aide to Senate President Pro Tem Joe Scarnati, a Republican, wrote in an email that it is, quote, "simply an attempt by the plaintiffs to get the Supreme Court to order the General Assembly and the governor to raise taxes." The partisan lines here are even more blurred. State Rep. David Parker, a Republican from the Pocono Mountain area, stood arm in arm with Democrats and advocates after the hearing, decrying the state's position.
I'd like to do better as a legislature, but if we can get some pressure from the judicial system to do that, then let's do it. I mean, we got to get it done, and we haven't gotten it done for 25 years. We shortchanged schools all over the state.
The court gave no timeline for its decision. Kevin McCrory, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the four-station partnership. Still ahead, the Fringe Festival, currently underway across Philadelphia, is a celebration of the new and experimental in the performing arts. Yet this year, several of those works focus on some enduring female characters hundreds of years old.
Her story becomes a kind of screen that people can project onto. Each culture, each age projects what they want to see.
Casting old characters in new locations when News Works Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to News Works Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. One hot-button political issue throughout Pennsylvania is the plight of the coal industry. Marie Cusick of State Impact Pennsylvania visited one community hit hard by the state's reduction in coal in order to gauge their feelings as the Pennsylvania election approaches.
Every year, the King Coal Parade winds through the center of Carmichael's, a small town about an hour south of Pittsburgh. People line up to see the fire engines, classic cars, floats, and marching bands. This year, at least, some are arguing about the election.
Oh, the coal industry. Guess who ain't for coal?
I think, you know what?
You want
the
who ain't coal?
The coal industry was been around here for a long time.
And you know who ain't for it?
And that was people's bread and butter.
It's fair to say the presidential race has people pretty fired up and worried. That's because times are changing. Just ask 17-year-old Morgan Voighthofer, who was crowned coal queen in the annual pageant. She says she's thinking about moving away to pursue a career in acting.
People have been losing their jobs, and many of the mines have been shutting down.
Over the past 4 years, Pennsylvania's lost about 3,000 jobs in the coal industry as it faces tougher environmental regulations and competition from cheaper natural gas and renewable energy. The downturn has hurt people like Raymond Beckett, a mine electrician who lost his job in March.
It's been a tough year, yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm 52 years old, and where am I going to find a job? Nobody even wants to look at me.
His unemployment is running out soon, and he doesn't know what's next.
This is all this area is known. It's coal and steel.
A lifelong Democrat, Beckett says he switched his registration to Republican before the primary to vote for Donald Trump, who he calls the lesser of two evils.
I don't think he'll be worse than anybody else that's been in there.
Greene County has been shifting from blue to red. In 2000, Al Gore beat George W. Bush by 10 points here. But the county has gone for Republican presidential candidates since then. There are a lot of Trump yard signs around now, which isn't surprising because he's been courting votes from coal communities across the country. Here he is at a rally in Kentucky.
We're going to bring the coal industry back, folks. We're going to bring it back.
Trump doubts the mainstream science about man-made climate change. He wants to roll back environmental regulations and lift a moratorium on new coal leases for federal land. When asked in Greene County if they really believe he can bring back coal, people often react with anger toward Clinton. Trump supporter Angela Smith is the daughter of a retired miner.
I mean, I think that if he can't, he can't. But he's willing to try. Hillary's like, let's just close down the coal mines.
Another guy leaned into the microphone but didn't want to give his name.
If Donald Duck was running for president against Hillary, I would vote for Donald Duck. I don't have any use for her, period.
A lot of people are mad about a comment Clinton made earlier this year.
We're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business, right, Tim? And we're going to make it clear that we don't want to forget those people.
She later apologized, saying that's not what she meant. But Clinton does think climate change is a real threat, and she's put together a $30 billion plan to reinvest in coal communities, which includes expanding clean energy projects and retraining workers. Her message has resonated with Don Fike, who lives in Carmichael's but skips the King Coal Parade. He's an ex-Marine and former coal miner going back to school under the GI Bill. He wishes others could use it too.
Coal miners are some of the most innovative people you ever meet. So I think that they do need a retraining program to help them out.
But perhaps not surprisingly, there is a fair amount of skepticism about presidential candidates promising to help.
They're talking about it now, but it should have been talked about 5, 10 years ago, 15 years ago.
That's Greene County Commissioner Blair Zimmerman. A former miner himself, he's a Democrat supporting Clinton, but says both parties have let down coal country over the years.
Coal is hanging on, but by a thin thread.
Zimmerman thinks coal is still king, for now, just barely, and hopes the region can develop a more diverse economy in the future. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Lady Macbeth, the Greek priestess Io, Ophelia. In the midst of very new theater works, this year's Fringe Festival also features some familiar literary women, though transported far away from their original stagings. Their appearance highlights how much women's roles in society have changed, and in other ways, how little. WHYY's Kimberly Haas reports.
When playwright Amanda Coffin decided to base a new work on mental health issues and their stubborn stigmas, women's concerns rose to the surface.
The idea that there is still something like histrionic personality disorder that someone could be labeled with today, which is, of course, a throwback from when women were diagnosed with hysteria.
To demonstrate that much has not changed, Coffin turned to some female characters who have been around for a long time. Bedlam, Shakespeare in Rehab, ponders the question, how would the bard's women be diagnosed today?
We wanted to look at the idea of modern mental health and the stigmas that are attached to that, particularly for women. The characters in each of these plays have been given certain labels. The most frequent characters that come to mind when you look at madness would be Ophelia and then probably Lady Macbeth. So we wanted to explore what that meant and whether that is a valid diagnosis for them to be quote unquote mad.
I think it says more about our attitude toward women than it does about mental health in general.
Barbara Lonquist teaches English at Chestnut Hill College.
The melancholy woman, the hysterical woman. Men never suffered from hysteria. It was a women's condition.
Similarly, the subject of suicide prevention inspired another play with another of Shakespeare's women. Drowning Ophelia is being staged by Ensemble Atria and Eager Bisc Theater. Victoria Ray Sook plays Jane, a 21st century woman grappling with emotional troubles.
She deals with loss and grief and her mental health issues through talking to her imaginary best friend, who happens to be Ophelia as written in Hamlet.
While in Bedlam and Drowning Ophelia, the heroine's characters stay intact as they're transported into a modern setting. In another Fringe show, Exile 2588, the personality of Io from Greek myth is updated. Nick Gillette is co-founder of the presenting company, Almanac Dance Circus Theater.
We've taken a number of liberties with the original myth. The original is Io as a figure is so passive. She is seduced, she is exiled, she is punished and tortured by gadflies and is driven across the world. We've kind of altered that to allow her to begin with just a little more agency of the ability to get herself into the trouble that she'll eventually be able to overcome.
Some women are so distinctive, even just the name can be a launching pad.
Colette was a trailblazer. She was a strong woman, iconic. She did things other women didn't do, and she challenged the norm.
Celeste Walker has written and is performing Colette Reloaded in this year's Fringe Festival. Though her Colette character is not the French author, Walker says she was still an inspiration in this story of a woman's battle within herself.
Maybe subconsciously I was calling upon the French Colette to help me with this struggle. Everybody has this kind of alter ego within oneself. Wanting to be accepted, wanting to be loved, wanting to be a good girl with the need to express yourself and need to be your own person.
Updated or not, why do these female characters still resonate so strongly over the centuries? Barbara Longquist thinks they represent enduring and adaptable archetypes.
Her story becomes a kind of screen that people can project onto. Each culture, each age projects what they want to see.
Yet some of the very traits that make these women memorable ultimately lead to their downfall.
Strong women, they're remembered as troublesome. I guess liberated women often couldn't be happy in the end.
All four plays are part of the Fringe Festival, underway now in locations around Philadelphia. For WHYY, I'm Kimberly Haas.
Finally this evening, a casting call has gone out in Philadelphia, though it's not for the next Rocky film. On Saturday, the City of Philadelphia's Office of Emergency Management, along with other organizations, including the American Red Cross, will host an evacuation sheltering exercise. They're looking for around 100 volunteers to play the role of disaster evacuees so that responders can gain experience interacting with real people rather than dummies or imagined victims. And with the city's animal shelter also taking part in the drill, they're looking for pets, too. This note from the city: instruction will be provided, so no prior acting experience is required. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Simon Hauger is a Philadelphia teacher who's an advocate for workshop education. He's featured in a TV documentary on schools of the future, and we'll talk with him on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.